This is the 27th broadcast in the America Looks Abroad series presented by the officers and staff members of the Foreign Policy Association. This nonpartisan organization, open to all who are interested in American foreign policy, offers accurate information on current world events. In the world of today, foreign affairs are your affairs. President Roosevelt, in his message to Congress on Thursday, said, "Let us examine without self-deception the dangers which confront us." Mr. William T. Stone, Vice President of the Foreign Policy Association and Director of its Washington Bureau, will speak to you from the nation's capital. He will discuss America and the European crisis. Mr. Stone.
Good afternoon. The great battle for supremacy now joined in Europe has brought the United States to the threshold of momentous decisions. To measure the change which has swept over Washington since Germany launched her attack in the West, it is only necessary to ask a single question and to compare the answers with those given 6 months ago, a month ago, or even 2 weeks ago. The question may be put in several ways, but in essence it is this. How would the vital interests of the United States be affected by a decisive German victory? 6 months ago, both Congress and the executive were whispering the question, but evading the real issue which it raised. At that time, almost no one in Washington believed that a decisive victory by either side would be possible for a long time to come. The policymakers at the White House and the State Department had already made up their minds about where our vital interests lay. President Roosevelt had warned that this nation could not hope to find security for itself or its institutions if the rest of the world should be dominated by force. And his foreign policy advisors at the State Department were proceeding on the premise that our own interests would be very gravely jeopardized in both Europe and Asia by an Allied defeat. But Congress was still reluctant to accept the premise and questioned whether our real interests were directly involved. It approved the president's program of measures short of war, but only on condition that our aid to the Allies was kept within the limits of technical neutrality. A month ago, the question began to be asked openly when the invasion of Norway and Denmark brought home the gravity of the Allies' position. Congressional opinion began to shift, and many who had denied that this country had any vital concern in the outcome in Europe began to revise their earlier estimates. But even then, the shift was not decisive. Today, the trend is unmistakable. The direct effects of the events of the past few days are seen on every hand, in the huge emergency defense program moving swiftly through Congress, in the hurried consultation between the diplomats of the American Republic, in the landing of Allied troops in the Dutch West Indies, in the sending of American consular officers to Greenland and Iceland, in the retention of the United States fleet in Hawaiian waters, in the overshadowing of all domestic issues in Congress and in the growing atmosphere of strain and tension here in Washington. The issue which is now shaping is not whether this country is concerned with what is happening abroad. That is now conceded. The issue posed by President Roosevelt in his message to Congress last Thursday is how to organize our own first line of defense in the face of new dangers. The external dangers are only too clear, but there are internal dangers too. One immediate danger is that we will give way to hysteria and that decisions will be taken in panic rather than by considered judgment and a cool appraisal of the situation which confronts us. Now, in appraising our position in relation to the present crisis, it's important to keep several key factors in mind. The first key factor is time. Another is our insular position between two oceans. And still another is the productive capacity of American industry. Time is an important factor in all calculations affecting both national defense and foreign policy. During the past few days, the Nazi war machine has obliterated Holland, overrun most of Belgium, and broken through the little Maginot Line to penetrate deep into France. Many qualified military experts in Washington believe that the great battle now raging on the Western Front may be the decisive turning point in the war, and that the issue in this battle may be decided within the next 2 weeks, possibly even within the next few days. But if the issue in Europe should be determined in the next 2 weeks or even in the next 6 months, there is very little that this country can do to affect the outcome. The new national defense program cannot be put into operation overnight, and the production of 50,000 airplanes is likely to require anywhere from 18 months to perhaps 2 years. On the other hand, if the German offensive can be checked, if it fails to produce an overwhelming victory before the end of this year, the time factor may alter the situation in several ways. One possibility is a military stalemate in which neither Germany nor the Allies are able to achieve a decisive military result. Another possibility is that other nations will come into the conflict, altering the military balance of power and extending the war to new fronts. Still another possibility is the break in civilian morale within the warring countries following a military setback. Now, in writing his message to Congress this week, President Roosevelt obviously took these time factors into account. He underlined two primary objectives. First, the long-term objective of providing the essential equipment for a vast expansion of the land, naval, and air forces. Second, the short-term objective of increasing the productive capacity of American industry, particularly the aircraft industry, as rapidly as possible. He said very little about how the expansion of airplane production would be used in the short run, but he clearly implied that this country has a vital interest in the successful resistance of the Allies, because it will take us a long time to organize our own defense effectively. If the Allies cannot make a successful stand, we face the task of defending our interests single-handed in the Western Hemisphere. Therefore, one of the most significant statements in the president's message was his warning to Congress not to take any action which would in any way hamper or delay the delivery of American-made planes to the Allies. This means that the first step in the program will be to sell the Allies all the planes and all the equipment and all the war materials that we can produce in order to gain time to expand our plant capacity and to build up our defense in case of their defeat. If this extension of the policy of measures short of war is to prevent an Allied defeat, however, the rate of production will have to be stepped up enormously. At the present time, the maximum output of our aircraft industry is only about 350 planes a month, including commercial as well as military types, for the United States, for the Army and Navy, and for foreign countries. During the first 6 months of the war, our actual deliveries to the Allies totaled only about 700 planes, due partly to bottlenecks in the machine tool industry and partly to a serious delay in the placing of large Allied orders. The rate of production is likely to increase rapidly in the next few months, but the most optimistic estimates in Washington don't place the rate at more than about 800 planes a month by September. Apparently, the only way to speed up shipments to the Allies would be to release military planes now in the units of the Army and Navy. The other key factor, our insular position between two oceans, was also brought home by the events of the past few days. Here again, we're faced with short-term and long-term decisions of the utmost importance. It is generally agreed that our Navy is more than adequate to defend the United States against invasion by any single foreign power. But it is not adequate to undertake major operations in both oceans at the same time, and there's a serious question whether it is strong enough for single-handed operations against Japan in far eastern waters, distant from our own naval bases. Last week, the occupation of Holland created an immediate problem, both in the West Indies and in the Far East. On the morning of May 11th, small contingents of Allied troops were landed on the islands of Curacao and Aruba, situated off the Dutch coast of Venezuela, in order to prevent possible German attempts at sabotage in the important oil refineries of those islands. State Department officials, who had been advised of the Allied move, took the position that the occupation did not affect the Monroe Doctrine, as no change in sovereignty was involved, and because the troops had been sent with the consent of the Netherlands authorities. On the same day, however, the State Department received sharp intimations from Tokyo that a similar landing of Allied troops in the Netherlands East Indies would be viewed with deep concern by Japan. The Japanese Foreign Minister, Mr. Arita, summoned the diplomatic representatives of the belligerent powers and the United States and Italy, and renewed an earlier statement of April 15th, expressing concern over the possibility of extension of hostilities to the Dutch East Indies. He did not say flatly that the landing of Allied troops in the East Indies would constitute a violation of the status quo, but Mr. Joseph C. Grew, our ambassador in Tokyo, wasted no time in communicating with Mr. Hull in Washington. As a result, Secretary Holliday's press conference on the same day reaffirmed the desire of the United States that the position of the Dutch East Indies should not be altered. Tension was reduced when Great Britain and Holland gave assurances that Allied military aid was not intended and not desired. But the issue in the Far East remains critical, more critical perhaps than most Americans realize. The United States is concerned about the status of the Dutch East Indies because it is our chief source of supply for two basic raw materials, rubber and tin, and our Navy is being kept in Hawaiian waters. Japan is concerned with the Dutch East Indies because she depends upon them for oil, and her Navy is concentrated in the Western Pacific. Now, as long as British sea power remains unbroken in the Atlantic, the United States is in no immediate danger of attack on the continental United States, on the Panama Canal, or the east coast of South America, and we're free to keep our fleet in the Pacific Ocean. If British sea power should be broken, however, either by decisive German victory or by attack from the air, we would face new and very formidable problems. Then this country would be called upon to undertake the single-handed defense of the Western Hemisphere. This is the long-term prospect which confronts the United States in the event of a decisive and overwhelming German victory. As a military problem alone, it is not insoluble. Hemispheric defense is possible, and a two-ocean navy can be built, if necessary, to provide an impregnable defense for the United States and for America. A continental defense program was urged last week in the report of the Senate Naval Affairs Committee, headed by Senator Walsh, which argued that a policy of armed isolation would be infinitely less costly in the long run than allowing ourselves to become engaged in the war in Europe. But in either case, we face a series of difficult adjustments with regimentation and concentration of economic and political power at home. There is room for a difference of opinion on the course which this country should follow in the weeks which lie directly ahead, but there is no longer any question that we are concerned and very vitally affected by the outcome of the present battle in Europe.
Mr. William T. Stone, Vice President of the Foreign Policy Association and Director of its Washington Bureau, was today's speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. If you would like a free copy of this talk, send your request to the Foreign Policy Association, 8 West 40th Street, New York. We invite you to tune in next Sunday to hear another speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. This is the National Broadcasting Company.